Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artists First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. And please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You were tuning into Chit Chat Cafe Live After Dark. This show airs every Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more information about this show and to listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/chitchat.htm. And don't forget to follow Artists First on Twitter. You can find us under the Twitter handle at @artist_first. And now here are your hosts of Chit Chat Cafe Live After Dark, Lisa and Nancy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome. Lisa from New Jersey. Welcome to Chit Chat Cafe Live After Dark. We are airing live from Artists First. We're excited to welcome back Dr. Jen Hartstein. And during our second half hour, Teresa Flores. She's the author of The Slave Across the Street, an activist for human trafficking. Trafficking, I can't talk tonight. Also, we're joined by our Hollywood connection, David Daniel from CNN, the senior producer for the entertainment news. And we're going to be discussing Dick Clark and our hot topics. Well, welcome, David, and welcome, Jen. Dr. Hartstein, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me. How are you guys doing?
Oh, it's our pleasure.
We're happy and busy.
Yeah, busy as well here in Hollywood, although happy might not be the word the last couple of days.
Mm-hmm.
There have been happier weeks to be an entertainment journalist. And Dick Clark, certainly the biggest name and the most influential overall, but just in the last 24 hours, you know, we've learned of the passing of Jonathan Frid, who was Barnabas Collins on the original series Dark Shadows.
Oh, yeah,
right.
Oh.
Yeah, he didn't do a lot after that. He went back, well, a lot that was visible to Hollywood. He went back to Canada. He's a native Canadian and did a lot of theater there, stayed out of the Hollywood limelight. And he actually has a cameo in the Dark Shadows movie that Tim Burton made, starring Johnny Depp as Barnabas Collins,
mm-hmm.
next month. So we lost him. We lost Greg Hamm, who is best known as the flute and the saxophone player for the Australian band Men at Work. They had a couple of very big hits when they were around. The flute solo on Down Under, which may have been their biggest hit, that was him. That wonderful saxophone solo in Who Can It Be Now? Wonderful riffs that are memorable. And he was in his late 50s and was discovered dead at his Australian home today. And then one we had been anticipating, actually, LeVon Helm,
right.
who was the drummer and the singer for the band, which began as Bob Dylan's backing band and went out on its own, an incredibly influential musician, has a voice on some of the biggest hits of the late 60s and early 70s, and really beloved in the musical community.
Mm-hmm. And whose daughter I actually went to camp with, so kind of...
Really?
Amy Helm, 1 Degree of Separation.
Really?
Remind
us of that famous song. I'm trying to think of his famous song.
The Weight is probably the one that you're remembering. But, I mean, there were...
Up on Cripple Creek, they sang.
Right. You'd be reciting pretty much a catalog of late 60s, early 70s
mm-hmm.
through them all. He's a Rock and Roll Hall of Famer. You mentioned Amy. Something that I hadn't realized, you know, I love this trivia. Amy's mother,
mm-hmm.
After she... separated from LeVon, married another incredibly influential musician. I don't know if you know who that is.
I don't think I do.
And now, of course, because I have to say it, the name has flown out of my head. But he's the leader of the group Steely Dan. Stepfather.
I can see him in my head. It'll come to me.
Right.
Small world.
And Amy's in a band that... like a folk rock band also that's actually a really great band called Olabel. They play a lot around New York and in different festivals and stuff. So
oh, of course. I didn't realize that was...
Yeah?
Of course, the name just came back to me. Donald Fagen
mm-hmm.
is her stepfather. So musical talent and family, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, families, that was the whole key to Dick Clark's success, is that he brought... rock music, at times music that was considered dangerous or out there, you know, into living rooms. You know, 25 years before MTV, Dick Clark's American Bandstand was the, you know, pick your modern day version. He was the iTunes, the Spotify, the XM radio of the early and developing rock and roll era. It's why his passing, as you know, perhaps as expected as it was, he's certainly not been in the greatest health since his stroke almost a decade ago. But that's probably why it hit people so hard, is the memories they have of American Bandstand and of everything else that he touched.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Lisa and I are both originally from the Philadelphia area, and that's where they filmed it live.
Absolutely.
At WFIL.
Mm-hmm. But did you know he wasn't a novice when he started working on Bandstand in Philadelphia? He had moved there to work for a local radio show, because radio is where he really got his start. His dad had owned a radio station in Syracuse, I think, Syracuse, New York, and he had worked there and gotten, obviously, his love for music and his chops as an announcer, and then came to Philadelphia, and you know, where he was chosen to be the host of Bandstand, and within a few years, he had gone national with it, started out local. He had taken it to Hollywood and, you know, taken over the show in all ways, taken over ownership of the show by that time, by the mid-60s. By that time, he already had a star in the Walk of Fame. I mean, you want to look at the longevity of a man. He got a star in the Walk of Fame in 1960.
Wow.
Wow.
He famously wasn't satisfied with the success there. He had already formed his own production company long before that. He was determined to own the properties that he developed and to expand as much as possible. He hosted, of course, the $25,000 pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
You know, starting back when it was just the $10,000 pyramid. You know, that was real money. still is, actually. He actually won 3 Emmys for hosting Pyramid.
Wow.
6 Emmys overall, but more than anything else, it was for hosting that. And he understood, I think, that to make an impact on the American public, you had to involve yourself in as many different venues as possible. And, you know, these days, that's old hat. You have, musicians who also have clothing lines, and they make television appearances, and they're in movies, and they have fragrances. But Dick Clark understood very early on that if he didn't reach someone through American Bandstand, he'd do it through hosting this game show. He'd do it through creating the American Music Awards. He really, as much as anybody else, was responsible in some ways for rock and roll becoming an international industry, and the record business itself becoming international, the way he pushed boundaries like that. Now, coming from Philadelphia, even after the show, I've got to ask you too, even after the show moved to Hollywood, it became national, did Philadelphians still have a special tenderness toward Bandstand and toward Dick Clark?
Absolutely. Yeah. They felt like it was their...
He's our guy.
What was that?
He's our guy.
Yeah, they just feel like, you know, yeah.
Well, I was very fortunate in the, like, it was like either 1979 or 1980, my husband and I, we weren't married at the time, but we got to be on American Bandstand twice, dancing.
That's great.
Oh, you met Dick Clark in person then?
What'd you say?
You met him in person, Dick Clark?
I didn't actually meet him. There were so many dancers. He did his job. We did our job. Everything was scheduled, so I did not get to meet him.
Oh, wow. Cool, though.
Well, I haven't had that pleasure and didn't have that pleasure. I am very fortunate, I'm very happy, that my young daughter is old enough probably to remember last New Year's Eve, because, of course, that's the last time that he appeared on his other mm-hmm. perennial show that made him such a household face and name, Dick Clark's New Year's Rockin' Eve. He had been doing that. Okay, here's some trivia for you. Who did he replace? When he started in 1972, he started replacing someone else, Guy Lombardo.
Good job, Lisa.
Well done.
Lisa came back from Spain with all of her trivia intact.
I know. Excellent. Cheers to Lisa.
Yes, Guy Lombardo had been the host, and he took over in 1972, these celebrations from Times Square, which I really think, and I'm going to spread the cause here, I think that they ought to rename Times Square now after Dick Clark.
You think?
It hasn't always been Times Square. It was named about a little over 100 years ago. It was called something else. It was called Longacre Square, and they renamed it after the New York Times because the New York Times building was there.
That's true.
Maybe Dick Clark
had their century.
I think it would work. They'll probably name a street after him or like the the middle absolutely. Little part, the middle walking path or something after him, but, you know.
At least.
At least something like that.
Think of how many millions upon millions of people associate a day of the year,
mm-hmm.
not just an event, but a day of the year with that celebration, with that visual of the ball dropping, and Dick Clark for, you know, close to 40 years hosting our New Year's Eve parties.
Right.
Amazing. Well, let's conjure up some more memories of Dick Clark for our next get-together. David Daniel, this is wonderful that you joined us. We always love you to join us on Chit Chat Cafe Live.
It's always my
pleasure. And share your trivia.
I'm glad to. Next time I will try to remember all the names that I want to bring up.
Oh,
having
well,
to search my memory.
And, think of us when you walk past Dick Clark's star.
As I do. It is right there at the corner of Sunset and Vine, not too far from the Los Angeles Bureau, and I walk past it daily. And, of course, it's been thronged with well-wishers and with flowers in such the last couple of days, but a reminder of a true giant of entertainment.
Well, thank you very much for sharing this memorabilia.
Thank you. Take care, both of you.
Good night.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Well, everyone, I'd like to introduce our first guest, Dr. Jen Hartstein. She's a nationally recognized child, adolescent, and family psychologist in New York City, contributor on CBS The Early Show, and the author of The Princess Recovery, a how-to guide for raising strong, empowered girls who can create their home, their own happily ever afters. Welcome, Dr. Hartstein.
Thanks. It's a big title, huh?
Yeah.
I can't fit it on Twitter.
You can't. It doesn't really work. It's true.
Tell us about the Princess Syndrome.
So the Princess Syndrome, you know, we're not going to find it really in any book probably but mine. It's not really a medical diagnosis, but it's this idea that kind of little girls are being trained and raised as entitled, expect it all, you know, focused on appearance, not on substance kinds of young women and older women. And we know how problematic that can be because it really doesn't teach them how to take care of themselves, be sufficient, own themselves in a way other than kind of on the superficial. And that can be incredibly problematic in building relationships with both themselves and other people.
And you describe problematic lessons our daughters learn. What's the difference between boys and girls other than the obvious?
Well, you know, it's a really good question, and it's very funny because I've been getting a lot of, you know, where's the boy version of the book? But, you know, the fact is that boys get different kinds of messages and can equally learn that these girls kind of are the damsel in distress, so to speak. And learn that they have to take care of them. And there are a lot of women who, you know, we still have this idea that men are supposed to take care of women, and boys learn that early, and they're bombarded with these same images and have to figure out how to understand what they mean also. And I think that it's equally as challenging for boys, and although the book is really focused more on the girls' struggle, I think some of it can be applied to what's going on with boys, too, you know, how to be manly and man up and not cry and not show your emotions. I mean, that's equally as damaging for boys as it can be for girls to be so overly emotive and expect everybody to take care of themselves.
What, like the stereotypes you see all over the media, how does this influence the girls?
Oh, it's horrific. You know, think about if we all kind of were to stop and think about what's the image that we're supposed to, quote-unquote, look like. We as women, you know, I'm sure the two of you equally to me worry about, well, what are people thinking when I wear this outfit, or if I don't look great in this, what are people going to say? And, you know, Ashley Judd just came out with this fabulous post on the Daily Beast about comments being made about her appearance and how inappropriate it was. And it happens all the time as women. So now be 6, 7, 8, 9, and there is this Barbie look, there are the Monster High dolls, there's the Bratz dolls, there's these images constantly being tossed at them that they're supposed to look and act a certain way. And we as women can kind of separate what's reality versus not. 7, 8-year-olds can't. And so they really need their parents to be aware of the media message so they can help the kids understand what the media message is and how to decipher it.
How can we help them? We should help them.
Well, I think the first step is really understanding. It's a very good question. And I think the first step in helping girls especially is to understand what your own relationship is with appearance, trying to, you know, kind of keep up with the Joneses, so to speak? Are you talking about your own weight, your own appearance, your diet, all of those things all the time? Because your daughters are going to pick up on that and think that that's the most important thing. So first you need to understand what your own relationship is. Are you reading all the gossip magazines and commenting on it? You know, what's your own relationship with that? And then you need to figure out what you want the values your daughter to have, and how to teach her that. You know, if you know, one of the big discussions certainly is about Disney princesses and how the message of princess gets relayed, because that's certainly, if we look at the larger culture, where most of the princess messages come from. And if you don't agree with those messages, how are you going to counteract that? Are you going to put them in sports? Are you going to teach them how to do team things? Are you going to teach them how to give back to other people so that they don't only expect everything to just kind of come to them or the prince to save them from the tower? And that's a real struggle. But it really starts for parents with themselves and understanding their own relationship with that stuff.
Well, even though this is National Princess Week, you're already starting to describe in your book, I love it, the difference between the princess versus the heroine.
Right.
Help us understand that. Your book.
I also just want to stress, you know, I get a lot of pushback on, well, girls love dress up and love to be princesses. I was a princess, you know, I'd be lying if appearance didn't matter. You know, but it's about having the heroine values of, you know, I believe in myself, or I can find my self-esteem, or, you know, it's not just about me, it's about giving back to others. And so it's finding that balance, you know, going from wearing your princess crown to going and playing in the mud, and not being the person who shies away from that, not being afraid to get your hands dirty. And those lessons start at a very early age for a lot of these children. And it's important for us to teach them that you can wear your tiara proudly, like by all means wear it proudly, and don't be afraid to chip in and do the nitty-gritty stuff. And that's really more of the heroine value of standing up for yourself, learning to believe in yourself, learning to feel empowered, rather than waiting for other people to do it for you or expecting that.
And I really enjoy your book when you give examples. For example, value brains over beauty.
Mm-hmm.
You comment, in quote, for the princess, it would be appearances or everything, but the heroine would be smarts pay off.
Yep, right. The thing I actually loved about writing the book is that I'm not giving any majorly research-based crazy advice. You know, Peggy Orenstein wrote the book Cinderella Ate My Daughter, which really talked about the research behind the problem, you know, where all of these kind of princess beliefs and the girly girl culture stemmed from. And there was the what, you know, what's the problem? And I wanted to look at kind of, well, how do we deal with the problem? What are the messages we want our girls to get? Feel good about being smart. Feel good about liking science and building things and technology and math, you know, and there's all this really fascinating research coming out about how girls aren't getting access to those things still today, even when we think that they're getting equal opportunities. They aren't getting the same access to science and math, or they're not being promoted to do that. They're not being encouraged to be playing outside. Boys get more of that. And not that it's always boy versus girl, but girls need to be doing those things to really meet their most potential, too.
And we need to talk the talk and demonstrate this to our young
girls. Absolutely. It starts with, you know, every parenting expert says it, and I'm not going to be any different, that, you know, it starts with the parents. Like, model what you want them to be. And I had a friend who was busy, you know, counting her calories on her iPhone, and her daughter had, like, an old iPhone that she used more for music and little movies and stuff, and she shouted to my friend, "Hey, Mom, I need to log my calories," and she's six. Does she really know what that meant?
Oh.
Right. It makes you, like, want to vomit. Does she really know what it meant? I don't know. But because she sees this happening with her mom, which was seemingly innocuous enough, she's now going that route. And we know, you know, eating disordered behavior is starting younger and younger in kids that are in elementary school. They're seeing this message. And so we, as the adults in their lives, need to put forth what healthy is, not what impaired judgments are. And that's why it has to start with looking at your own behaviors.
Exactly. Well, as a parent and a teacher myself, I believe early on telling both sexes, but especially girls, tell them you are smart in science and math.
Mm-hmm.
The more they hear it, the more they become it.
Yep. And that you can do anything you want. You know, there was just a kind of a blog post going around the internet about kind of a mom talking to her daughter and kind of saying, you know, you're a step behind the eight ball. You know, you're basically you're screwed. Well, but in much more graphic language. And then an argument, you know, a post in response to that was like, you're awesome. Like, embrace your awesomeness. You know, you are great. You are terrific. Just because you're a girl doesn't mean you have anything bad for you. You can be great. And if you start that message early, you know, we know that when girls hit middle school, more so than boys, their self-esteem definitely drops. And a lot of times that's because their bodies are developing at rates they don't really understand, and they're not sure how to negotiate all of the relationships, and the cliques start up a lot more. But if we can build that self-esteem in these younger ages, they'll maintain it longer. And we have to promote, as you just said, the idea of, you know, be the best you can be all around and find the thing you love. Don't decide that just because math might be a boy's thing that you shouldn't do it. Do all of it. And boys, the same thing. If you love art, if you love dance, why not promote that too? You know, boys can like princesses
parents,
too.
Don't you think a lot of parents are raising their kids to, like, I don't know if it's really the parents' fault, maybe it is, like the world revolves around them? I mean, kids have a sense of entitlement now, these young people.
Yes.
The world owes them, and they're going to be in for a rude awakening when they get out into the work world.
Oh, well, yes, and parents overfunction for their kids. And I think that's, you know, a secondary problem, which is not only is there this belief that I can do it all, you know, that everybody owes me this, but there's the secondary belief that, you know, that if I can't do it, my mom and dad will swoop in and fix it for me. And so there are a lot of, I certainly see in my private practice, you know, 19, 20-year-olds who are back home and out of college because they never learned how to function for themselves. So there's this secondary problem of like, well, I'm never going to have a problem because someone will swoop in and save me. And so I do think that there's a disservice done to many of these kids because they just don't know how to function. And they think that, well, you know, they talk back and they're rude and they kind of act in ways that, I don't know, I never would have certainly acted in my house. A step beyond normal even a step beyond that normal teenage talk back, you know, mm-hmm. And it's starting much younger. And I think that parents need to be able to remember that they need to parent and not be friends with their kids. You want to be confidants and friendly, but you don't need to be your kid's friend. You need to be
exactly.
Their parent. And that's a hard place for a lot of parents right now to feel. They work a lot, they're committed to a lot of things, and they feel badly they might not be able to be as present as they would want. And I would say, your kids know you love them in lots of different ways, and setting boundaries and setting limits is what they need. And in fact, we'll ask for a lot of the time. You'd be surprised that kids want rules. They want to understand what is expected, because then they know what the expectation is if they screw up and what the consequence is. There's no guesswork.
Exactly. Your book is amazing. Again, we're highly recommending it.
Thanks.
Recovery.
Everybody should read it.
Yeah, a how-to guide to raising strong, empowered girls who can create their own happily ever afters.
Yay. Everybody should pick up a copy.
Absolutely, because guess what? It's very worth reading.
Thank you guys very much.
Young girls, a lot of anguish.
Yes, and I had a friend say that she wanted to recommend it to her mom friends because she thought that they could actually benefit from it more so than some of their kids could.
Well, we're going to feature it on the Chit Chat Cafe Live Book Club.
Great. Thanks, ladies.
Hi. Thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Again.
Bye. It's an interesting concept, you know? Very, very, very interesting.
Exactly. I loved it, this book.
And I say it. I say it with my daughter and the kids in high school.
I can tell you.
Very independent. I
was smiling because I was the mom that let my daughter wear her tiara while she was holding worms.
Right. Yeah, my daughter, God, is sensible.
Yeah, that's nice.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, we'd like to thank our sponsor, St. Croix Orthopedics. We're going to take a quick commercial break. Stay tuned. We're going to be joined by Teresa Flores. She's a survivor from human trafficking. How do you say that word?
Trafficking.
Trafficking. And author of The Slave Across the Street. We'll be right back.
And now back to Chit Chat Cafe Live After Dark on the Artists First World Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone. We've been waiting a long time. We actually learned about Teresa Flores the night of the Super Bowl, watching Nightline. We are very honored to have Teresa Flores. She's a survivor of human trafficking, author of The Slave Across the Street. She's a licensed social worker, seen on Nightline, America's Most Wanted, The Today Show. And she's going to talk to us tonight about a very serious subject, about human trafficking. Welcome, Teresa.
Wow, great. Thank you.
Well, we're so honored, and we've been following your work as an international speaker, giving lectures on human trafficking from both a personal and, you know, perspective as well as professional expert. Mm-hmm. Could you share with our listeners your story from your book, The Slave Across the Street?
Sure. I was actually just a normal teenager, brought up with a mom and a dad and in a good family, and I wasn't, you know, a runaway, and I didn't use drugs or anything, and was a good kid. And we moved around a lot because my dad was a businessman, like he was a big executive. So we moved every 2 years because he got promoted. And it was a lot of fun for a while, but as I got into high school, it got tougher to meet new people and be, you know, make friends. And so we ended up moving to a suburb of Detroit, and it was very upscale. And I was approached by a gentleman, a young man, who I soon developed a crush on. And he was different than most of the boys that I went to school with. But my parents were really strict, and they had said, you're not allowed to date him until you're 16. And it was just really, you know, kind of simple when I look back on it. I went to track practice one day and went to my locker, and he was standing there, and he just offered me a ride home from school. It was just as simple as that. And, of course, here I am, you know, a 15-year-old, and I have a crush on him, and I'm not allowed to go out with him. So I basically jumped at the chance, you know, and I figured it's just a ride home from school. It's safe. And unfortunately, that was a bad choice because he didn't take me home. He took me to his house where he said he had forgotten something and just needed to pick it up. And I was very trusting, and I kind of ignored all the red flags that were going on that day. And he asked me if I wanted to come inside, and I said no. You know what I mean? I said what my parents would have wanted me to say. But after about 6 months of him constantly being around me, saying the things that I wanted to hear, all he had to do was say, "I like you." And I basically threw caution to the wind and went inside. And unfortunately, all those red flags that day had been right, because he drugged me with a pop that I didn't know had anything in it, and he proceeded to rape me. Ooh. And yeah, it was horrible because I was a virgin, and my family really valued that. So when I went home, I didn't tell them that because I thought they'd be very disappointed in me and very angry, and you know, I wasn't supposed to have gone with him. So I just thought that, you know, I would deal with that on my own, probably like a lot of teenagers out there. But if, you know, had I told my mom, you know, things would have been totally different. Because a couple days later he came to me and he said, I need to speak to you. He said my two cousins were there as well, and they were taking pictures, and they have a plan, and you're going to earn these back or else.
Oh, my. And again, this is something that you couldn't talk to your parents about.
No, I didn't feel I could, you know. And I didn't even imagine that it would come to something like that, you know what I mean?
Right. And you come from a great family. You're the oldest granddaughter of a judge.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I bet you couldn't imagine this happening to you. What did you say to him about the pictures?
Well, he actually showed me several, and it's just amazing, you know, how things look, you know, you can't imagine. But he said, you know, we're going to show him to your dad and to his boss at work, and this is where he works. I mean, they did their homework. And he said, we'll put them around school, and we'll show them to the priest at church. So so I basically was being blackmailed and threatened to do this. So
now, did these young men, were they about his age?
They were older. He was several years older than me, though he was in my same grade, and then his cousins were several years older than that, and then in the grade above that. But, you know, it became apparent that this was a huge underground criminal, you know, ring that involved a lot of people.
Well, it seems like you were psychologically and physically tortured at that age.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have the I own you attitude?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, you are nothing. You have no value whatsoever, and you know this. You know, this is beaten into you. I remember on one night, an older man came in with the trafficker and said, you know, really simply, you know, what's your name? And I didn't answer because you're not permitted to speak and you're not permitted to, you know, make eye contact. And
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you said why. Yeah, so he turned to the trafficker and asked him, you know, what's your name? And the trafficker looked at him really quite disgusted and said, what does it matter? She has no name. And that's exactly, you know, that feeling that you get when you hear that, that's exactly what it feels like. So,
well, at the time that you're talking about, there were no laws then.
Right.
When you were kidnapped by these men, you were a junior in high school, is that correct?
Yes.
And you were taken, I've read that you were taken to an inner city, Detroit, nasty, dirty hotel after you were drugged and beaten and sexually molested to the point of unconsciousness.
Mm-hmm.
How did you even have a clue as to what to do to get out of there?
I didn't. I had absolutely no idea. I was at that point just stumbling around and through this parking lot in the inner city with no clue of what to do. I had no money, no ID, no idea where I was. I mean, just total, total darkness and despair. I had no idea.
And were these men able to find you and follow you and keep track of you then?
Yeah, I mean, they still were. By then, though, the police were involved, and so they were just kind of changing their tactics. They didn't stop by any means, but they changed how they would take me out at night and everything. They would take me out of school instead of at night, and so they were making an awful lot of money that they weren't planning on stopping anytime soon.
And through all of this, your parents didn't recognize anything wrong with you?
No, I mean, they just basically thought, I mean, they knew that, you know, I was acting different. They knew that my grades were dropping, but they thought maybe I was just having a hard time adjusting to the new school, you know, a hard time making friends. I mean, there was just absolutely no way that they would have ever fathomed, you know, something like that was going on with their daughter.
Well, you write that you were a Catholic,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, as a student, did you ever feel that you could talk to perhaps the priest or a teacher that you could trust?
No, I didn't. The threats were just way too high. It just was not, they were always watching me, so they were always around, and they had said, you know, if you ever tell anybody, we're going to hurt your brothers, and so the consequences would have been just too high.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So what advice do you have for young girls that are going through this now?
Well, you know, I definitely recommend that if they're going through something like this, they really do need to reach out to somebody. It's I mean, you could wait your whole lifetime waiting for somebody to reach out to you. And the reality is that most girls die in this. Most girls don't escape like I did. And it does take a lifetime to heal from it. So if they're going through something like this, you know, find somebody that they trust to talk to. There's a national human trafficking hotline number that they can call and just to talk to somebody and see what their options are too.
And how did you escape from this?
Well, my dad's company had told him that we were not going to be moving anymore, that we were, you know, basically stuck there. And I was really worried because I thought, you know, if that's the case, I don't know what my life's going to be like. And it was just kind of really miraculous that one day he came home and said, you know, I got a phone call and they are moving us to the headquarters, which was hundreds of miles away, you know, wasn't close. And so they put us up in a house for the summer, so there was really no way to track and to trace where I was going. So it was just truly, truly a miracle the way I was able to get out of there.
Oh, well, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
And we really applaud you. You went on to become, to get your master's in counseling and education.
Yeah. I was found and determined that once I escaped that I wasn't going to let them have the rest of my life.
Hmm. Do you think it affects you right now in your life? Do you ever think about it still?
But I do this full time now, so it's kind of hard not to.
You know what I mean? What I mean?
Yeah.
Do you get depressed or like?
Oh
you get
yeah,
mad?
Definitely. Yeah, it's something that you know, I got mad one day because I thought, gosh, I'm not as healed as I thought I was. But I realized at that point that it's not a destination that you reach; it's a journey, and it's just something that you deal with every day. Of course. You know, I'm healed enough that I can be able to go and talk around the country about it and stuff. But, I mean, yeah, it's hard to sleep still. And, you know, I do take medication for depression. It's just something that you have to be very careful about. And there's triggers, you know, but when you can recognize those and prevent those things from happening, you're much better to have a normal life.
Do you ever see these guys anymore or know about them? Do you ever see, like, are they on Facebook or do you ever?
I looked for them on Facebook, couldn't find them. And they still are out there. They never were prosecuted. There was no law against us back then. And so I have Googled them. I know where they live. But I'm sure they know about me as well, what I'm doing. So I have not seen them. I think that if I had seen them, I wouldn't be talking to you today. So.
Now, are your parents still alive?
Yes. Yep.
And what do they say about all this? Are they upset that you didn't say anything to them?
I don't know about that. I think they feel very bad that, you know, they didn't catch this, that they didn't see. And I try to reassure them and tell them that, you know, I made it really, you know, hard for them to be able to tell. I was hiding it very well because they were going to kill my parents and my brothers if I told anybody. So, you know, I was really good at hiding it. So, I think it would have been difficult for them to notice. But there are things, you know, that I do recommend parents do if they think something's going on with their kid now.
Well, share some of those with our listeners. Perhaps someone that's listening right now could benefit from this. What are some of the ideas that you share?
Really simply, just checking your kid's bed every night. It sounds so silly, but it really, I mean, if my mom would have just gotten up and looked in my room and seen I wasn't there, you know, things might have turned out differently. So that's just a real simple thing to do. I have a security system on my house. I mean, they're very cheap. It's $20 a month, and every time, you know, a door opens or a window opens, it goes beep, beep, you know. I mean, you can tell if someone's coming in or out. And I just believe very much on, you know, cell phone trackers and knowing your kids' passwords. knowing where they're at, parents' phone numbers. We've gotten pretty lazy as a society, and just because we're so busy, and we're going, we're working, we're, you know, living outside of cities, we're traveling a lot, we've got kids in sports, and so we've just kind of gotten lazy about checking things, and unfortunately, the traffickers are getting better and better.
Now, in my research, I live presently in Minnesota, and my research with your work, Minnesota, as well as Ohio and other Midwest states, are some of the hotbeds. Of course, we expect it from, I think you've mentioned, California, Texas, and Florida.
Right.
But the Midwestern states have become, Ohio is the number one state for human trafficking. Is that correct?
Toledo, Ohio, is a number one recruitment hub for teenage prostitution. So I rank it as California, Texas, and Florida as your top three. Minnesota, Minneapolis particularly, as number four. And then Ohio is number five.
Minneapolis, Nancy.
Right. Now, why Minneapolis, Minnesota? Why?
Why different, same reasons for Ohio. You know, your extensive highway systems. You know, you have a lot of people coming in and out of there from other states. You have large immigrant populations, lots of colleges and universities. I'm not sure if you have military bases there. Tourist attraction areas. All of those things make a state very vulnerable to being a trafficking location.
Now, how did these traffickers approach young girls?
They really spend a lot of time just looking for the vulnerable girls. We've gotten a really wonderful DVD that is a pimp talking about how does he find which girl that, you know, he wants to approach and who he thinks will fall for him. And they'll go to the mall, and they'll look for girls walking around by themselves or no packages or late at night. And they also look for girls in groups of three. And they don't approach the prettiest one, and they don't approach the ugliest one. They go right for the middle girl. And all they need to say is, you have pretty eyes. And by their response, they know if they can get her or not.
And what do they do once she answers them and they think they can get her?
They just kind of turn on the charm. They offer to buy her things. If she's with just three, they try and separate her and get her outside of that. But they just really tell the girl everything that she's been wanting to hear. So we always recommend that. You know, we start telling our teenage girls or our, you know, adolescent girls that they're pretty, and we give them compliments and everything, because that's what these guys are doing, and we want them to be used to that.
Feeding their self-esteem.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So say one of these three falls for their charm and is separated. What's the next step?
From him or?
Yeah. You know, so that we'll have an understanding of this.
Yeah, they'll spend up to 6 months just always being there, talking to her, you know, maybe buying her a cell phone that's just so he can get a hold of her, and buying her new things, making her feel very special. And they take it really slow. It's on purpose so that she begins to fall in love with him and trust him. And then slowly he will try and get her away from her family, away from her friends, and really isolate her. And pretty soon she'll run away with him.
This is very interesting. I was always under the impression that it was more of a kidnapping situation right away.
No, that's actually only 3% are kidnapped. But we do know that 100,000 American youth are being trafficked right now. So really, if you think about it, 3% of 100,000 is still, you know, quite a large number, especially if it's your child.
Exactly. Now, we've mentioned the states. What I'm curious about, once these youth are taken, where are they transported to?
all across. There's a huge circuit that's, you know, encompassing many different states. They are advertised on Backpage.com, and they travel around a lot of times. You know, not just Las Vegas, but Seattle and Portland and Minneapolis and Chicago, Detroit, and, you know, Columbus, Indiana, Indianapolis. So there's a huge circuit, and they just go from city to city to city, advertise them for a couple days on Backpage.com, make their money, and go off to the next city.
Now, what do they say, for example? They run ads?
Yeah, any big city or even average cities have back pages. And you go to the escort section, and you can see for yourself just how many women and girls are for sale on there. They will go and take pictures of the girls and then post them. And it says right on there, you know, $80 an hour or, you know, $100, you know, anything goes. It's quite blatant, and it's very surprising.
That's terrible. Well, Teresa, we would like our listeners to know that you've been appointed to the Ohio Attorney General's Commission on the Study of Human Trafficking in 2009, and you were testifying before the Ohio House and Senate in support of the human trafficking legislation. Your efforts were a major part of the success, and I believe it's SB 235 being passed into law by Governor Strickland on December 23rd, 2010. Are you still involved with some new legislature?
Yes.
Today?
I was honored with the Courage Award from our new governor, Governor Kasich, last month, and was actually honored to be able to tape a public service announcement with him that we hope, you know, every TV station and radio station will play in the state of Ohio. And we have a new legislation that we're proposing, and it's a child safe harbor law. And only a few states in the U.S. have this type of law.
Tell us about that.
It's really interesting. It basically aligns itself with federal law. There is a federal law that says that any person under the age of 18 that is involved in any form of commercial sex is considered a human trafficking victim. And unfortunately, what happens is we arrest children for prostitution, and we don't see them as human trafficking victims when that's what they are. And because no child, you know, chooses to do something like that, and they're all being coerced by another person. So by enacting this law, it would give people it would give law enforcement the ability to help rescue the girls instead of arresting them. But it also is bigger than that. It also would mandate training to every law enforcement officer in the state. And it would put together services for these victims. I mean, when we get them and we rescue them, they need housing. They need, you know, everything. They come to us with their clothes on their backs, and that's it. They've a lot of times have dropped out of school. So having a law like this would give us the ability to provide services for them, to rehabilitate them.
Well, we are applauding you. That Courage Award that you spoke of, we would like our listeners to know that you, Teresa Flores, you were one of three people in the state of Ohio to receive this very first ever Courage Award from the governor of Ohio. And we would also like our listeners to know we have a link on our Chitchat Cafe Live website that will directly take you to Teresa Flores' website for more information, and we're proud of you, especially with your soap that you donate to these hotels with information and a phone number, just in case that young girl, like you said, where would someone find a phone number? On the bar of soap.
Mm-hmm.
We are so honored and proud. We would like to hear back from you. Would you join us again sometime?
Oh, definitely. Thank you.
And Chit-Chat Cafe Live, we would like to do everything we can, too, to put an end to human trafficking. Teresa Flores, we applaud you and thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on the show.
It's very interesting.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Bye-bye.
And again, we have a link on our website. We're encouraging anyone who would like to be involved or learn more, click on Teresa Flores' link and you can go right to her website. This is something that's very close to my heart. Lisa and I have talked about things that we champion, and missing children has just been something that's been a part of my life that I stand behind. So this was just a wonderful interview tonight, Lisa.
It was very interesting.
So I just really applaud Teresa Flores for turning her life around, getting her master's, and helping other young girls. Well, we're thanking our sponsor tonight, St. Croix Orthopedics. And we're also thanking Corey King, our producer. You can enjoy his Corey King show every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Artists First World Radio Network.
And I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Jen Hartstein, Teresa Flores, and of course our Hollywood connection, David Daniel from CNN Entertainment News. Go to our website and download some of our previous shows. You can just go to the website, scroll down to the date that you'd want to listen to, click onto it, and enjoy some of our past chats with some cool people. Nancy, this has been a really, really interesting evening. We've had some deep topics, but it was really good. But I'm going to leave everybody with a fun and uplifting quote. Well, it's kind of interesting, not so much fun and uplifting.
Good. I love your quotes.
Okay. This is for girls. Find someone who will ruin your lipstick instead of your mascara.
I love
everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Bye.
Bye.